I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait. What do cisgender women and men have in common? They both make up nearly half of the global population. But disparities between the two are alarmingly clear. Globally, more than 1 in 3 women have experienced sexual violence, a rate that is more than twice that reported by men. And women account for 54% of people living with HIV globally. The list goes on, with inequities affecting every aspect of women's lives. What that data tells us is that targeted efforts to create equality for women globally are more important than ever. Fortunately, as our guest today will soon demonstrate, this work has already begun. I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
And I'm Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director for the Global HIV Franchise at Gilead Sciences. And welcome to another episode of Zero Hour. This podcast is intended to be a space for open conversation on global perspectives on HIV, health, and health equity. Our guests for this episode are two women who work at the intersections of women's health and HIV. Dr. Regreshi Dharawan has worked in East London since 2008. Her work focuses on addressing disparities in healthcare systems and improving care for marginalized populations living with HIV. She's a physician, consultant, and researcher specializing in women's sexual health and HIV medicine. Rakaya Hassanbe is a project manager at Ikambe, an organization working to empower women living with HIV in the Greater Paris region. Ikambe also trains hundreds of healthcare professionals and social workers in France on the specific sexual health issues faced by women living with HIV. Rakaya oversees the association's programs that focus on health and quality of life of migrant women living with HIV. Let's start with one of my favorite creatures on earth, the elephant in the room. David and I are two men who are allies in this discussion, and we're going to be led in this conversation of women's health by two amazing cis women. In this conversation, we want to define cis versus trans. And so we will start with you, Dr. Regreshi. Can you tell us what is the definition of cis and trans?
Hello there. So for cisgender women, their gender identity matches that with the sex with which they were assigned at birth. And then for transgender women, their gender identity doesn't match the sex that they were assigned at birth.
Thank you. And for this episode, we will be focusing on cis women. And with that in mind, Dr. Regreshi, talk about what are you so passionate and what has brought you to be so passionate about women's sexual health?
I think it comes through my clinical practice from all the women that I've been lucky enough to work with over the years, seeing all the social inequalities that they face and just how they, you know, manage to overcome that. It makes me really passionate about wanting to work for their health.
What are the key barriers that you see in the women you serve?
So I think there are lots of different things going on. Some of them are related specifically to gender. As we know, actually around the world, the majority of people living with HIV are women. And I think it all comes down to gender inequality, which is inequalities around power. So we know that, you know, women around the world are less likely to complete education, which means they're less likely to be economically independent. They're also the carers of the world, and care is often unpaid. So these are women who are less independent and less able to perhaps look after their own health. And this means that they may be less likely to test for HIV, and once they're in care, may not be able to take their treatment or attend clinic as regularly as they may like to. So really trying to work out what are the issues that we can help them with is, I think, a really important part of our job as clinicians.
Dr. Ragashree, how can we improve access to healthcare for the women you work with?
So I think, first of all, thinking about stigma in terms of accessing HIV testing and prevention, poverty. So that could include time poverty, being busy with many jobs or caring for children. It can be poverty in terms of getting to clinic, or digital poverty, not having access to a phone or the internet. It may be due to their mental health. It may be due to their migrant status, so not being aware of what services are available to them. It could be due to things like partner violence and not actually being able to leave the house to come to clinic.
Dr. Ragashree, you mentioned digital poverty. What do you mean by that?
I mean, when people don't have money to, for example, own a telephone or have a telephone with which they can access the internet. So it means that they are less able to have telephone appointments or to have video appointments. The first thing we really need to do is to ask them what will help. We need to think about how to take that out of sexual health services to services where people may, where women may be more likely to use. So, for example, their family doctors or family planning services, for example. The same with HIV testing, thinking about how to access it outside of sexual health as well. So if they're attending, for, say, for example, the hospital for something else, could we offer them an HIV test then? And then when it comes to providing HIV care, really trying to be flexible. So flexible in terms of where they can access care, in terms of our clinic timings, thinking about the ways in which we deliver appointments. So, for example, would they prefer a telephone appointment or would they like to see us face to face? And then once they're in clinic, really thinking about their life outside of clinic. So, you know, what's going on in their lives? Are there any things we can do to better support them in their care? So, you know, do they need to see a social worker to get advice around benefits? Are they a migrant who needs some assistance with applying for a visa?
Dr. Ragashree, we spoke a little bit before about family planning, sexual health, pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means that people take a medication while they're HIV negative to prevent them from getting HIV. Do you see those in your practice as separate and distinct entities that we need to do a better job about merging together?
I really do. And I think there needs to be more of an emphasis on kind of women's health across the life course. So perhaps women could attend a center where they get all their needs with regards to their sexual and reproductive health looked at. So, you know, centers that provide contraception, do cervical smear tests, centers that in which you can have an HIV test, you can have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis. We can also think about women later in the life course, so with family planning, and also thinking about menopause further down the line, and perhaps even cancer screening, such as breast cancer screening. And I think it's really important to put HIV in the middle of this, because it means that we're not isolating it from other health conditions. And I think that normalizes it, which is a really good way of trying to challenge stigma. I think putting them all together means that we're not separating HIV out from everything else, and it normalizes it.
Can you talk more about this digital, right? So we're going into this space where there's really a lot of conversation of digital health and telemedicine, as you said, letting people receive their care. What considerations should we have around the digital space now?
So I feel like we've been talking about telephone and video appointments for a very long time, but I think we were kind of pushed to do this during the COVID pandemic, when we just weren't able to see so many people face to face. I think we really became aware that not everyone has access to a phone, has access to the internet, and actually some people prefer to be seen face to face. And for some women, especially those who perhaps are experiencing partner violence, their home is not a safe place for them. They may not be able to talk about their HIV at all. So for them coming into clinic, it may be better. So I think really trying to understand what patients want, what women want, what they feel safer with, and what they have access to is important. So we need to provide a range of options, I think.
Yeah, what are the programs that you've seen do that, normalize PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis for women?
So I think in the UK, we've still got a lot of work to do. At the moment, we haven't had PrEP available on the NHS for very long. And looking at uptake rates amongst women, they still remain very low. But there has been a lot of research done, which has been asking women about where they want to get PrEP from. And many of them don't want to come to sexual health services. They want to go to their GP and ask for it, or they want to get it when they're getting their contraception. I think we also need to think about other ways, such as postal prescriptions, for example, and just really making sure that our healthcare colleagues in other specialties are aware of PrEP as well, so that women can talk to them about it.
And just for our listeners out there, by NHS, you mean the National Health Service in the UK?
I do.
And general practitioner is for a GP as well, correct?
Yes, that's right. Family doctors.
Got it. Let's bring Rakaya into this conversation. And Rakaya, tell us your story. How did you become so passionate about just the work you're doing at Ecombere?
So today I am part of the executive team at Ecombere. And initially I have a background in global health policy. And I worked in policy institutes in Malaysia, South Korea, and France. But I felt like I was lacking some knowledge on what was actually happening on the field and what communities were facing to be able to design a good policy. And I was lucky enough to come across this book called Ecombere, La Maison qui relève les femmes, which means Ecombere, the home that lifts up women. So this book was written in 2019, and it basically tells the story of the founder of this association called Bernadette Roy-Guerra, as well as the story of these women that Ecombere supports. And I was absolutely inspired by the story. Ecombere was born in 1997. It was founded by Bernadette Roy-Guerra, who conducted a research study on migrant women living with HIV in France. And she realized that these women were completely isolated, ashamed, and in extreme poverty. So she created a daycare center. So Ecombere is a daycare center, which is located in Saint-Denis, which is just in the north of Paris. And it's one of the poorest cities in France. So we're a daycare center open from Monday to Friday, where women can come and have access to individual support on their social, health, and economic levels. They can also take part in various collective activities, such as sports, shared meals, sewing classes, dance classes, that enhances their self-esteem. In 1997, she created a safe space for these women to gather. Simply a space where they could eat, rest, and share their stories, the story of their illness, of the stigma, and of migration. And soon she realized that this space was not enough, that she had to design a holistic approach to accompany these women towards empowerment. And that's how Ecombere developed. So it's interesting. It's important to note that Ecombere has always evolved based on the needs expressed by the women. And so Ecombere became this community care center where we have social workers that take care of social issues such as access to rights or access to housing. We also have health counselors and specifically sexual health counselors who will guide these women to understanding their treatment and how they can improve their quality of life. And then we have professional integration officers or counselors, which will guide these women on how they can enhance their skills and specific training to get access to economic empowerment.
And what I love what you're saying about Ecombere is the focus on the social issues. And I think we're at a point in the epidemic where we have the medications, we have the technology, we have the resources, but the social development, the social progress lags behind, particularly for women. The women that you really want to focus and help, how do they find Ecombere?
Ecombere works closely with healthcare providers and specifically hospitals in the greater Paris regions. Women are referred to us by clinicians and doctors who know of Ecombere because Ecombere also has a presence in these hospitals. We both have professionals who refer women to us directly and Ecombere's health counselors who are present in the hospitals and who can refer women to the association directly. When we're at the hospital, hospitalized patients are not the majority of the people that we see. Actually, we see mostly people who are in consultation rooms doing their checkups. Since the creation in 1997, we have worked closely with hospitals because healthcare providers have always told us that they can't do enough at the hospital to support these women. So they will refer them to us because they know that HIV means social death for these women. So no matter what the clinician will say, if they do not accept the disease, if they don't have the tools within themselves to accept that they can be empowered with their health, they won't be able to move on. And we also play a role in hospitals themselves to facilitate the dialogue between patients and healthcare providers, especially when it comes to cultural barriers or barriers regarding language.
You both have spoken about migrant issues and some of those concerns when trying to access HIV. Can you both speak, and we'll start with you, Dr. Regreshi, about the needs of migrant women? What are some of those needs to address those concerns?
I'm thinking particularly about a woman who was a migrant. She'd been in the country for about a year, and she came over to get married, and she, you know, she very happily got pregnant very quickly. And as part of her pregnancy bloods, she had an HIV test, which unexpectedly became positive for her. So her pregnancy had kind of gone from being this very happy thing to being something in which she was very scared about her health and the health of her baby. And I can remember meeting her in clinic. And, you know, we have a very good multidisciplinary clinic. So we have HIV specialist midwives, we have psychologists, we have peer support, and of course we can provide treatment. So all those things really reduce a woman's chance of passing on HIV to her baby. But unfortunately, during her pregnancy, when she told her partner about the HIV, he ended up being quite abusive to her, and she had to leave him. And then in terms of how that impacted, how that interacted with her migrant status, it meant we really had to work to try and find out a home for her. So we know that migrants in the UK, for example, have different rights when it comes to being able to get housing or being able to get welfare. So, you know, it was more difficult to try and find her somewhere safe to live. And we worked very closely with our local violence against women organisation to try and organise that. And because she was a migrant woman, she'd come over here to get married to her husband. She actually didn't know many people apart from him and his family. So she was also very isolated and lonely. And putting her in contact with peer support, I think, was really beneficial, because she met other women who'd been living with HIV for a long time. Many of them had had children. And she was able to find some community. And after a pregnancy, I can remember seeing her a few years later. You know, she was like a different woman. She was very empowered. She had a healthy baby. She was employed. You know, there are lots of specific issues that migrant women face, but I think there's lots of things that we can do to kind of offer them to make sure that they're able to live happy and healthy lives.
Rakaya, what about you? When we look at migrant women and the concerns, how do we build a system around that?
In terms of barriers, for me, there are three different levels. There's the individual one, the community one, and the institutional one. Individually, these women, when they learn about their diagnosis, it's often a huge surprise. They're not ready for it. They don't understand how it happened to them. And they feel completely destroyed. Their self-esteem is shattered, and they think their life is over. A lot of the women that we see for the first time at the organization, they tell us that they, you know, they want to put an end to their lives. At the community level, there is a huge stigma around women living with HIV. And they end up living with HIV, and then they end up being victimized for living with HIV. So what happens is they're completely isolated, they're rejected by their family members, their intimate partners. This stigma, not only around HIV, but also around gender, social status, being migrant and being a black woman, all of this interacts and really has an impact on their self-esteem and on their capacity to move forward. And then at the institutional level, I'll just add that there are barriers when it comes to accessing rights in France, accessing housing. You know, a lot of these women, when they come to France, they don't know many people. When the few people they know discover that they're living with HIV, they end up without any solutions, especially when it comes to housing. The demand is growing around Paris for social housing, institutional barriers at the hospital. So sometimes communication between healthcare providers in France and these patients can be difficult and can be a barrier for them to accept their treatment.
Dr. Rageshri, I'll start with you. With regards to using the phrase or the word migrant, define what that population looks like. Where are the migrants coming from? Because I think we use that term a lot, but where are they coming from when you see them in your clinic?
Patterns of migration have really changed over the years. And I think initially, particularly in the 80s and 90s, we saw a lot of migration from sub-Saharan Africa. And that's been reflected in our clinic population. But certainly, I would say at the turn of the century, in the last two decades, we're seeing people from everywhere around the world. So, you know, people from South America, people from Asia. I'd say more recently, we're seeing people from Eastern Europe. So it's a real range.
Rakaya, who are the women that Ikambere serves?
The majority of women supported by Ikambere are from sub-Saharan Africa, specifically West Africa, which is also French-speaking. So countries like Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Gabon, Republic of Congo. So a lot of these women are migrant and undocumented, and they face difficulties accessing rights, housing, employment, and they're also generally very isolated.
And both of you have mentioned abuse, violence. What is the relationship between violence for women and HIV? And I'll start with you, Rakaya.
Violence is a factor of HIV, and it's a huge one. When we listen to the stories of the women that we support, we see that a lot of them are exposed to violence from childhood all the way through adulthood. It starts with things like female genital mutilation in their home country, abuse by some family members in their home country. A lot of them will actually flee their home country because of violence. But then they'll just be exposed to even more violence because they'll be migrating through Africa, being victim of torture, rape, all types of sexual abuse. They'll finally be able to escape that and arrive in France, where as migrant women, they'll be facing violence again. They'll be often living on the streets and therefore victim of sexual abuse. As a matter of fact, we know that a lot of women will accept to be housed by men who will abuse of them. Because they know that in return, they'll get a roof under their head and they'll get food. This imbalance of power will also mean that these women will be threatened by these men that, you know, if you don't do what I'm asking you to do, I'll report you to the police. You're undocumented and you'll be sent back home. What's also interesting is that there was a research that was conducted in 2015 in France, which showed that about 35 to 45% of these migrant populations actually get infected in France, which means that there is a close relationship between poverty, extreme poverty, and HIV.
I think that's such an important point because I think one of the misperceptions that we see when we use the phrase or the word migrant is that the migrant is bringing HIV and there's this kind of us versus them situation that plays out. Dr. Rageshree, is that how the relationship between violence and HIV is being seen or being experienced by the women that you serve in the UK?
We know, for example, that migrant women may not know where to access healthcare and that when they do access it, they may experience some discrimination. So when we think about institutional violence against women living with HIV, we need to consider those things. And we also know, unfortunately, that for decades that women living with HIV have, for example, experienced coerced sterilization or coerced abortion. So a study that I did with colleagues in East London about 10 years ago, where we surveyed the women attending our HIV clinic, actually found that over half of the women had experienced partner violence in their lifetime. So that's more than double women in the general population. And this was really striking to us. Although we knew this was happening globally, the research had never been done in the UK before. And this led on to national guidance being written around how to ask women about their experiences of violence, but also how to support them with that. And we know that experiencing violence puts women at higher risk of getting HIV. For example, they may not be able to control when they have sex, who they have sex with, and whether they can use condoms. And we also know that once women are diagnosed with HIV, they're at higher risk of experiencing violence as well. And there's a real stigma around experiencing partner violence. So it's something that women tend not to talk about. It's often known as a silent epidemic. And when you add that stigma to the stigma of living with HIV, it means that these women often feel very isolated and it can affect their mental health for years, even after they've experienced the violence.
You both, for me, highlight the challenges, some of the challenges that women face, that stigma, right? Like it leads into this stigma conversation. What does stigma begin to look like and how is it impacting their care? And I'll start with you, Rakaya.
Stigma looks like social death and rejection. Stigma impacts these women in the sense that, first of all, they don't think that they can trust anyone around them anymore. And it's very difficult to move forward when you feel like you have no support at all around you. And that's why peer support, like the one that we provide at Icomberet, plays a key role. We have women that we empowered 10 years ago, 20 years ago, who then, you know, found a job, got a job. And then once they reach retirement, they come back to Icomberet because it's their family home. So they're here every day, you know, sharing meals together, doing activities with the other women. And they play a fundamental role in breaking the stigma for the newly arrived beneficiaries. Because they will show them that they went through similar experiences of rejection, of discrimination, of migration, but that they were able to accept what happened to them, do the work that is necessary to overcome the trauma as well, and to feel confident they can live healthy, happy lives.
Dr. Agreshi, let's come to you. When we talk about women and stigma, what does that look like and how does it begin to impact HIV care for those you serve?
So I've just got a woman in my mind, actually, when you asked me about that. And I actually met her about 15 years ago when I was doing a full-time job on the HIV ward. She was someone who was diagnosed a few years prior to that, but hadn't been attending for care. She had a very low CD4 count, and we were treating her for AIDS-defining illnesses like CMV, retinitis. And we treated her. She was on the ward for a few months. She had a young son that used to visit her, but she felt very stigmatized by her HIV diagnosis. And I can remember, you know, the whole team were trying to wrap care around her and ensuring also that she was linked into peer support, because we know that's so important with stigma. I then met her probably about 10 years later when I came back to the same hospital, but I met her in clinic and she was like a different woman. She was working. Her son was now much older, about to go to university. But she still told me that she hadn't really spoken to that many people about her diagnosis. Although she had made friends through peer support, people within her own community she was less likely to speak to. And she hadn't been in a relationship in all that time. So I remember telling her about You Equals You. And then I met her 6 months later and she was engaged. And basically there was a man that she kind of liked at church and she said, oh, we were just friends. But hearing about You Equals You was really life-changing for her because it really challenged her self-stigma. And this man, I think, had been romantically chasing her for a while. And she'd always said no because she was so scared about passing HIV on to him. But she was able to overcome this with this knowledge, to overcome the self-stigma, to tell him about her HIV, and they're engaged. And I just thought that was such a wonderful example of how you equals you in itself can challenge stigma.
So let's take an educational pause. Dr. David, tell me, let's give the clinical definition of you equals you.
Just for context, you equals you refers to the concept that taking HIV medications, if you're living with HIV as prescribed, getting to and staying undetectable, which means a viral load less than 200 copies, for at least 6 months prevents transmitting HIV to your sexual partners.
When we speak of programming, right, and the programs we need to design for women with all of these barriers and challenges you've identified, what does that look like?
So I think we have to really take a holistic view and really understand all the different portions of a woman's life, recognizing that HIV is just a small part of that. So really asking women what they want and designing services in mind, being very flexible, making sure we've got lots of social support in there as well as all the medical care that they need.
Rekhaya, what does a program designed for women begin to look like with all of these challenges?
First of all, it looks like a place which is non-judgmental and very warm and welcoming. These women who live with HIV, they've gone through so much violence and so much discrimination in their lives that they need to feel like they can trust again and they can be supported again. So I think this factor of being welcoming, friendly, and non-judgmental is first key. So we have to have a patient-centered approach, and we'll design a program around her needs. And then we'll have the collective aspect dimension of it. So at Icambere, for example, we have shared meals, we have sport classes, sewing classes, beauty sessions, and all of these collective activities will enable women to regain confidence, to share with the others.
Dr. Agreshi, what does person-centered care really look like for women?
So first of all, I guess making a space in which the woman feels comfortable to speak, knowing that she can trust the healthcare provider to really listen and take her needs into account to validate what she's saying. And then once we're able to find out from her what her needs are, making sure that we're providing that care around her. So I often think of a woman sitting in clinic, but then I kind of think of what's around her. What are all those things that affect her at home, and what can we do to support her with those things?
And Rekhaya, putting on your policy hat, what does person-centered care for a policy perspective look like?
It means understanding how social determinants, such as the housing situation, employment, economic resources, all of these affect health and healthcare.
What are the implications for having mental health issues as it relates to HIV care for the communities we serve?
I think mental health has a huge impact on people's HIV care and outcomes. I think it's really key to address any problems of mental health with patients in front of us. We know, for example, people living with HIV are more likely to suffer from depression. This may mean that they feel less able to look after themselves. They may not see themselves being worthy of being a priority, so they may not want to take their treatment or attend a clinic, for example. So it really affects their self-esteem. So I think being able to ask our patients at every clinical encounter, how are you doing? You know, how are you feeling? Any problems, anything that's stressing you out? And then having the ability to refer these women on for support, be that psychology, be that psychiatry, be that peer support, is really, really key. Because I think unless we really support women around their mental health, we won't get on top of their physical health.
And Rekaya, for you, what are the implications of having mental health issues as it relates to HIV care for the women you serve?
I know that we include mental health throughout the program to provide them with support. And we have experimented this interesting way, which is dance and therapy sessions. So we do that once a week with the women where we offer them a space. So it's done by, you know, a dance professor and a psychologist. And the two of them basically alternate between dancing and group talks.
That's dope. I just want to say that because bringing dance together with psychology, a lot of people would say, well, how are you going to pair those things? Not understanding that dancing is a form of therapy. It is a form of coping. I do want to ask both of you a question. And I know the work that you all do on the ground can be very, very heavy and draining. On a personal note, what is the connection that drives your passion for doing this work every day? I'll start with you, Rekaya.
We can really see the difference between when a woman first walks in and is completely reserved. You know, her head is looking down. She is in a terrible state. After a few months, sometimes years, we see her so confident, you know, smiling, working, having healthy lives, healthy babies. This just makes it makes me really passionate about the work.
Dr. Rageshree, the same question. What gets you out of bed every day, the passion to do the work that you do for women living with HIV?
So I think as a doctor, there are many different medical specialties I could have gone into, but I am so pleased that I chose sexual health and HIV. There's also thinking about the things that we can do to really help women as a whole. There are times when I've sat in clinic and felt quite helpless because I've not been able to provide the extra things that women may need. They've been out of my control. So, for example, their needs have not been medical. And then thinking about how outside of clinic, I can work with other clinicians, with charities, with policymakers to make change at a structural level and see then how that affects our women living with HIV as a whole has been really satisfying for me. And I think some of the most fun work I've done has been outside of clinic. It's been working with sexual health and HIV charities. And again, thinking about really innovative ways to transform people's lives.
Rekaya, can you talk to us about programming you've done, and one in particular, the Knowledge is Power campaign, or in French, Savoir, c'est pouvoir.
Yeah, I'll talk about the campaign called Savoir, c'est pouvoir. Recently, we developed a campaign with Gilead support, actually. So basically, what we've done is we've chosen certain topics, such as consent, access to contraception, screening, and as well, certain practices which are done by migrant women. And I'll just take 2 minutes to talk about that because, you know, we offer a space where women can talk freely about their sexual health and practices. And we discovered at the center that sub-Saharan African women have certain practices such as introducing products in their vagina, like ginger or lemon, because they believe that this will make their vagina more firm and therefore make it more pleasurable for their sexual partner. And these women are not aware that this is a risk for their health. It makes them more prone to getting infections. And healthcare providers are also not aware that these women have these types of practices. So one of the topics that we're covering in this campaign is the idea of introducing objects in the vagina, because we want healthcare providers and social workers to be able to, first of all, know about this and then break the taboo around talking about this to the women.
Before we wrap, just one final question for you both, and I'll start with you, Dr. Rageshree. What does the end of the HIV epidemic look like to you?
Well, that's such a big question. I think there's several aspects to that. I think one is about ending new infections. So making sure that people are tested early, they are able to access treatment, they are supported to become undetectable and to stay that way, to engage in care, meaning that there'll be less HIV being passed on. So I think that's one thing. But I think it's also about ending things like stigma. So making sure that people living with HIV face less stigma, meaning that people feel less stigmatized when they go to get an HIV test or to access HIV prevention services. That's what it looks like to me. So better clinical outcomes, less stigma, and also really ending inequalities. And I don't think we can really end the epidemic unless we address social inequality.
Rekhaya, what does the end of the HIV epidemic look like to you?
Global health and global justice are really intertwined. And we cannot end the HIV epidemic if we don't look at social inequality. And we must continue to talk about, for example, these women who are victims of, you know, institutional violence and the lack of policy as well at national and international levels that protects these women in their sexual health and rights.
You know, Chauncey and I want to thank you all so much for lending your voices and your expertise today. It's been amazing to listen to what you're doing, the amazing work. And although it can be heavy at times, it's really encouraging to hear some of the success stories that you both have told and how this inspires you to keep doing the work you do. To be a woman in today's world is to have your autonomy challenged, to have your safety threatened, to have your health and wellness overlooked while you continue to suffer disproportionately from HIV and other chronic diseases. We at Zero Hour, along with our guests today, don't say these things to create divides. We say them to mend divides. Because real change starts with loudly and resiliently speaking the truth for the protection of women everywhere. Will you lend them your voice?
My personal reflection on today's conversation is summed up by the great Dr. Maya Angelou, who says, "Love liberates." Subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. And for more information, please visit GileadHIVTogether.com. This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.